Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Yes, Dear Science. Oh, Dear Science.
And again, we need to put in a plug for MOTAT here because they've been very, very good sponsoring the show. And so all of you folk listening, head out to MOTAT, do all their stuff out there. It's a wonderful place.
What a cool thing for them to like put the thumb on and say, I'm going to sponsor that.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, we're really, really thrilled about this. And so thank you so much, MOTAT, for, I guess, allowing me to pontificate about science weekly, I guess, or fortnightly with Marcus. So, you know, that's a really, really good thing to do. So thank you so much.
Talking about real science on media, I mean, it's a dying thing, isn't it?
it kind of is. So real science as opposed to fake science. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I take your point there, definitely. Yeah.
Scary times. we'll try and keep the listeners less scared than they could be. What are we talking about today, Alan?
Well, we're going to start off with, okay, so everybody knows what the highest point on Earth is, don't they?
Yes. I've been watching a lot of QI, so every time people ask me questions that I think I know the answer to, I'm a little bit anxious. I'm going to say Mount Everest.
There we go. That's my understanding as well. The lowest point on Earth.
Well, I've already had a look at the article, haven't I?
Alan? Well, no. But you know, the supposed lowest point on Earth.
Oh, yeah. Like at on Earth, on the surface. Yeah, I'm going to say the Mariana Trench, isn't it?
No. The lowest point on land.
On land.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Ah, okay. So the Dead Sea.
The Dead Sea.
It's around about -430 odd meters below sea level.
Right.
And that's supposedly the lowest point on land. Until now. And so there have been some scientists from University of California at Irvine down in Antarctica. And they have been looking at a particular glacier down there, a thing called the Denman Glacier, which is apparently in eastern Antarctica. Now, I was thinking about this. Now, Antarctica's basically round, isn't it? So that's a kind of a circular landmass.
Yeah, I see where you're going with this.
You know, where's eastern Antarctica? Come on.
Because isn't everywhere in Antarctica east Antarctica?
Yeah, I would have said so. But somebody said that this is eastern Antarctica, but that's fine. Anyway, so the point of this is that they have now found a point under this glacier that is around about 3.5 kilometres below sea level.
Far out.
And that's pretty cool.
So because the glacier is over top of it, it's not underwater.
No, exactly, right. So it's not flooded or anything like that, so there's a glacier on top of it. And this is now the new lowest point on planet Earth at around about 3.5 kilometres
right.
deep. And so the way that they normally do this, obviously there's a lot of ice down in Antarctica and then there's sort of rock below all of that and everything, and they can measure generally the thickness of ice using radar, so using microwaves and stuff. And
right.
Firing through the ice and bouncing back and blah, 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 blah. But it was a bit difficult with this because apparently what it is a quite a sort of a narrowish trench. And when they tried to use radar on this, they were getting sort of interfering signals. The radar was hitting the sides of the trench or something and bouncing back. And they couldn't quite figure out, or they couldn't get a direct reading from.
So they're getting various readings that weren't really adding up. Yeah.
And so what they needed then to do was to use a bit of physics as well as their radar measurements. And what they then did was, as long as they knew how much ice was in the glacier, which they knew, and also the speed at which it was moving, then they could use that in collaboration with the radar data and figure out how deep this actually was. So doing all that, they then get to a depth of 3.5 kilometres, and that is now the new lowest point on land on planet Earth.
3.5 kilometres deep is pretty substantial. How many kilometres high? You don't know, is Mount Everest.
It's, I think, 8,848 metres, I think.
8,000, so.
So it's about 8 kilometres, yeah. So
above
it's about
sea
eight,
level.
Yeah, above sea level. So it's pretty high. So I guess in the grand scheme of things, 3.5 kilometres would be around about just a little bit higher than Mount Cook, I think, from memory. I think Mount Cook's about 3.4, 3.5,
that's
something like that.
Huge. It's very deep.
Yeah.
So, I mean, talking about this, the thing that interests me is what defines on land? Is that just if it is submerged by ocean?
Yeah, I would guess so, yes. Yeah, so on land, so obviously where it comes out of the ocean, and then you can have depressions within the land that then don't get flooded necessarily by the ocean and don't go underwater. So that's, again, that's my understanding of what they mean by on land. So,
I mean, but what about the bottom of a lake? Is that on land?
Nah, because it's flooded, presumably.
Right.
Whereas this is solid ice, so that's a different thing. Even though it's just water.
So if you're below sea level and you dig a hole, you go parallel to, I don't know, downwards.
Yeah.
You go perpendicular to vertical, let's say. AKA horizontal.
I think that, yeah.
This is why I'm here, just learning. And you dig straight across and you get to the ocean, would water just rush through and fill whatever area?
Yeah, it would do. Yeah, because you're going to come out well below sea level, so yeah.
Yeah, I'm never going to live anywhere that is below sea level, which apparently is everywhere in a few years.
Yes, well, we'll see about that, yeah. Yes, yes.
That's something else I was interested about this. If it is a glacier and, as we know, things are melting around the world.
Yes, indeed.
If this thing is melting, would that not fill it with water and probably create a whole bunch of issues? I guess that's just speculation, though.
Potentially. I know that down in Antarctica there are a couple of, I think, massive freshwater lakes below the ice sheets. Mm. So, again, the same sort of thing could happen here, I guess. But, you know, we'll wait and see. So,
yes.
Hopefully for a long time, hopefully before this.
Hopefully. we can only cross our fingers at this point. Or work really hard to help our damaged world.
Indeed. Yep.
Which apparently we're not very good at. Let's not get into that. That's like a 10-hour discussion we can be having. This next story I love.
Yeah, me too. I think
it's very, very interesting. It's about storing data in everyday objects.
Yeah, yeah. So this is very, very cool. Okay. So where to start with this? DNA. Let's start with DNA. Because DNA obviously holds the blueprints for life on Earth, okay? Mm. And, you know, everybody knows that, you know, that's the way that it works. They might not necessarily know how it works, but they know that DNA is basically holds all of the instructions you know, the replication of you or whatever piece of life.
Like a biological hard drive.
Yeah. Hey, well, very good. Oh, I like that.
I'll take it.
Right. And now, how does DNA work? Okay, so DNA works because there are only four bases. There's A, there's T, there's G, there's C. And A always pairs with T and G always pairs with C. And on that basis alone, you can store information using just those four individual bases, okay? Now, I guess nature uses that to store information about replication.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no reason why we can't use that to store information about any old thing, really. And so people have realized this in the last, gosh, I don't know, probably maybe 10 years or so, 10, 20 odd years, where we've finally got the technology to be able to dial up sort of bits of DNA with particular sequences on them, okay?
Right.
So, and so people have thought, okay, well, maybe we could use DNA to carry other sorts of information, okay? And it's been, they figure that in 1 gram of DNA there is the potential to store 215,000 terabytes of data.
I read that and I had to have a look into that.
Okay, so 1 gram, 215,000 terabytes of data. I also looked into this.
That's an unreal amount of information.
Well, okay, so for comparison, if you look at everything that Google, Amazon, Microsoft and Facebook have stored online, that comes to around about 1.2 million terabytes. Okay? So that's only about 5 times 215,000 terabytes, okay? So in other words, on 5 grams, roughly, of DNA, you could potentially store everything that Google, Amazon, Microsoft, and Facebook have got. Which, if that doesn't blow your mind, then, it's quite extraordinary.
It's quite extraordinary, also quite terrifying. There's a lot of applications for that probably aren't as happy as we'd like to think. Well, I mean, obviously, it's a fantastic thing.
Yeah, no, it's quite amazing.
On that though, you said theorized 215,000, but they've only managed to do 15 megabytes.
Well, no. Well, again, they're only using tiny amounts of DNA tiny here. Amounts. Okay, so a gram of DNA is a lot of DNA.
Yeah.
Okay. So. So what they're doing now, as I said, right, so there is this potential to store data on anything, basically,
right,
on DNA. And so these people have thought, okay, right, so what about when we make things, when we 3D print things, let's say we print something once, 3D print something once, if we want to do it again, we've got to then go back to the original sort of source, let's say, and... get the instructions from the 3D printer, etc., and you know, feed them into the computer, and then bum 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 bum, it'll 3D print. Why can't we basically incorporate the instructions in the thing that we're printing? And in order to do that, we're going to put in minute amounts of DNA into the thing that we're printing, and we're going to encapsulate those minute amounts of DNA in glass so that the DNA doesn't get damaged. And so, what this Israeli guy has done in combination with scientists at ETH in Zurich in Switzerland is basically just that. So what they did was they 3D printed a plastic rabbit, plastic bunny, okay? And in order to do that, they obviously needed instructions for the computer to be able to print that.
Right.
So they coded those instructions then on DNA. So they basically made some DNA and... coded those instructions so that they could be read as ones and zeros by, you know, by a computer. And as I say, they incorporated those little bits of DNA in these nano spheres of glass, made of glass, which they then incorporated in the actual plastic that was being used to 3D print this thing. Okay? They go ahead, they 3D print it, and then what they have got is this 3D printed plastic rabbit, which now contains all the instructions, and it was about, in terms of data, it was about 100 kilobytes of data, which is not very much at all.
No.
And they found that then they could take that out of the plastic bunny and generate another plastic bunny from those same instructions, etc., etc. And they could do that about five times, apparently. So this is sort of proof of principle stuff.
Yeah.
And then they thought, okay, well, how about rather than just instructions, how about a movie? Let's put a movie on DNA, okay? And so,
yeah.
so basically they coded a little movie, about 1.3 megabytes, I think, little movie, coded that onto DNA, and then again encapsulated the DNA into these tiny nano beads of glass, and then they incorporated them into the plastic lenses of spectacles. And so what this means then is that basically you can hide anything. Now,
yeah.
Okay, if you've got any data or something like that, it's going to be totally undiscoverable. You can incorporate it in absolutely anything, provided that you've got the not inconsiderable technology to be able to do this.
I'm interested in the encoding thing, because we're talking about how Google, Facebook, and what was it? All the big
and Microsoft
ones.
And everyone. Yep.
They have this certain amount of data, and we could have 215,000 terabytes.
Yes.
We're talking about.
Yep.
So you can encode this information on, but how... is it possible, well, at the moment, to update that information? Because if it's encoded into the DNA, surely it would be difficult to, like, take a movie out, edit the movie, and then chuck it back on the DNA.
Yes, it would. It would. Because what they're doing is that you have to create the DNA yourself.
Right.
And that's the limiting...
So the DNA reflects the information that you're encoding into
Absolutely. So once it's written, that's it. If you want to change that, you've then basically got to... probably either start from scratch and generate a new piece of DNA, or potentially with CRISPR and stuff like that, you could edit bits in the DNA and blah blah blah. But that would be difficult, okay?
Yeah, or force the DNA to replicate in the way that you want it. this specific story blows my mind, because it's one of those things, and it's happened a lot. I mean, it's happened forever and ever that something gets invented or someone starts pursuing an idea, and it feels like that thing could never have been theorized. Or, you know, there's all these like movies or whatever from the 80s, and they're talking about the future, and this is what the future's going to be like. They've got hoverboards and whatever it is. I'm basically talking about Back to the Future at this point.
We're still waiting for hoverboards too.
We really are. But disappointing, really. But this is that sort of thing that you just, until you think about it, until it happens, or until a movement is made on it, that you just couldn't really think about it?
Well, I'm sure there'd be some science fiction writer out there who has come up with a story, something like this. I'm pretty sure about that. But you're right. I mean, just how you would sort of conceptualize this, how somebody would come up with this and think, oh, shit, let's use DNA to do this.
Yeah.
I remember there's a band called OK Go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they were, I don't know whether they actually did, but they were going to release a single on DNA. That was one of their plans. Anyway, I'm not sure whatever became of that, but you know, you can do it. Obviously, you need immense resources and everything like that. Mm. And I think from memory, the cost of printing the instructions, or the cost of making the DNA with the instructions for printing that plastic bunny, was around about $2,000 or €2,000, something like that. So obviously,
it's an expensive process. Yeah,
it is at the moment an expensive process. But what with all our advances in basically synthesizing DNA, you know, this is going to become second nature in 5-10 years. Something like that.
Expensive. You're right. But if you're starting at a pretty breakthrough scientific stuff at $2,000, not too bad. It's better than like $1 billion that they're spending on all sorts of stuff.
Well, one imagines that the world spy agencies are taking very, very good notice of this, I would imagine.
Okay, let's just keep my anxiety levels at a minimum today. That'd be fantastic. We should probably move on to the last story, which is going to bring those anxiety levels right back up.
Yes, indeed, I know. Yes. So this is a story about ransomware. And for those of you who don't know what ransomware is, this is when you open up your computer and you get a bloody great message saying your computer has been hacked. If you pay us, you know, I don't know, 10, 20, whatever, Bitcoin or whatever, we'll, unfreeze it for you. If you don't, everything's gone, sort of thing.
Lovely.
And the very, very large chemical company Merck, who I'm sure many of you will have heard of, woke up to the scenario on June the 27th, 2017. And they inadvertently got caught up in a ransomware hack that emanated apparently from Russia and was apparently targeted at the Ukraine.
It's a bit topical, that one, isn't it?
I know. And so apparently Merck had a server in the Ukraine that became infected, and then rapidly that sort of went right around the world with their, you know, because everything's connected these days. That's the nature of, you know, the internet, etc. And so there were literally tens of thousands of computers and laptops and servers and everything in Merck. And basically the company had to pretty much shut down for a good couple of weeks. And so the Gardasil HPV vaccine, they couldn't make that anymore because, you know, all of their computers were down and everything like that. So they estimated that this cost them around about $1 billion
in a week.
Yeah, in a couple of weeks. So $1 billion. So they have gone to their insurers and they said, okay, so we're insured against this, so please pay up. And the insurance companies apparently said no. And the reason being was that the insurance company said that this was an act of war. And you're not covered for acts of war, apparently.
I mean, it's not often that I take the side of an insurance company, but kind of true.
Well,
I mean, the Russians are at war with the Ukrainians, or I should say the Ukrainians are at war with the Russians.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
We could delve into that, but we're not going to. And, I mean, they were targeting Ukrainian servers, right?
But Merck, or as Merck correctly says in the lawsuit, they said that they're not at war with anybody.
Yeah.
So, so this isn't, I guess it's not so much a science story, it's tangentially a science story, I guess, but it's very, very interesting to see what's going to happen here. So this is being litigated even as we speak.
Right, so and this is a recent thing.
Yeah. And so you can be damn sure that obviously whichever way this goes, there's going to be appeals up the wazoo and everything and blah, blah, blah. Blah.
I mean,
so it's going to take a while.
I mean, an insurance company versus a pharmaceutical company means money falling out everyone's ears.
I never thought of that, but you're absolutely right.
Yeah. Who's? I mean,
oh, the
both
lawyers will be loving it.
Both of those entities, have probably don't lose very often when it comes to lawsuits.
No, indeed. So,
be like a reality TV show.
We'll see where this one goes, but I guess keep an eye on the news and stuff. There should be a judgment. I don't know. soonish, I would guess, if it's in court now.
Well, I haven't heard anything about this.
Exactly. This is sort of the sort of thing that sort of flies under the radar a little bit because it's not quite mainstream-ish.
Yeah, and it's probably quite damaging to the image of a pharmaceutical company if their software or their hardware can get infected with a virus or ransomware.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Ransomware is a virus, right?
Yeah. Well, or a worm or whatever.
Because my understanding is that it inadvertently spread to this company, right? So they were targeting Ukraine. And due to a whole bunch of overlaps or whatever, or Merck had a server over there or something, that it spread over to their main base.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah.
That's very scary, Alan.
I know.
Scared me. So I haven't seen you in so long, and you come in here and you scare me. Well, thank you very much, Alan. It's been a pleasure having you in here and talking to you again.
Yes, indeed. No, it's all been all goodwill. And thank you, listeners, for listening and supporting this segment of BFM's output. You know, it's really, really nice to know that people listen and hopefully people get informed as well. So
As always, you can text us on 5395 or give us a call in studio on 309-3879 if you want to talk to me or Alan about this. Probably Alan, though. Thank you very much, Alan.
Okay, see you, Will.
Mind blown. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
You're tuned in.